Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. Everybody knows the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. But consider the alternative. There's a Henry James story about a man who goes through his entire life with a dark sense of foreboding, a fear that some awful fate is about to crash down on him. To fend it off, he lives cautiously, carefully, avoids all risk, and at the end of his life, on the very last page, finds out that nothing has ever happened to him. That was his awful and inescapable destiny. There are people, though, who seem to combine the Chinese and the Jamesian fates. In the beginning, their lives are way too interesting, but afterwards, not interesting enough. I met a man recently who had fought in the French underground during World War II. He was a teenager at the time. He saved lives. He took lives. His own life hung by a thread the whole time. At 20, when the liberation came, he was a national hero. His picture was in every paper. His suit coat sagged from the weight of all the medals and ribbons. Women named their children after him. But he was only 20. What to do next? He tried college. He tried racing sports cars. He tried alcohol. For a while, he smuggled diamonds. He became a poet and then a diplomat. He skied. He learned to paint. He sailed a boat across the Atlantic. I'm told he's a fairly respected Sanskrit scholar. But in his own view, his life after the age of 20 has been a complete failure. It's just, he said, that I've never been able to come up with a second act. The show you're about to hear now, from producer Nina Ellis, is called D-Day Diary. It's about a day, 50 years ago, that was both a first and a last act. Last, for the many who didn't live through it. The end, the beginning of the end, for the Third Reich. And for a lot of people, a first act, horrible and bloody, but a day so vivid, so wild, a day like a bolt of lightning, they'd never want to see it again, but, to tell the truth, they'll never see its equal either.
Fifty years ago, 3 million soldiers, American and British and Canadian, were in England preparing for battle. They'd been training for months to cross the English Channel and attack the Nazis in France. The Germans were expecting them and had fortified themselves. All along the beaches of northern France, in Normandy, they built concrete bunkers and installed cannons and machine guns. They put millions of mines in the sand and erected obstacles at the shore designed to rip through the hull of a boat. The Allied soldiers would come ashore at sunrise, June 6, 1944. It was called D-Day, and 6:30 a.m. was designated as H hour, the moment the invasion would begin. 176,000 men were to be transported across the channel in the biggest amphibious operation in the history of the world, 11,000 ships. The men would transfer to smaller landing craft called LCs and then be delivered to the beaches in groups of 30. They would land in carefully planned waves of attack and try to break through the German fortifications. Among the first waves were American soldiers of the 1st and 29th Infantry Divisions. They landed at a beach called Omaha, where things went terribly wrong. 1,000 men died on Bloody Omaha that day. The story is best told in the words of those who lived through the landing, words gathered from diaries, letters, and books, and read here by actors, memories of a day of war. June 5th, aboard ship in the English Channel.
There were probably more than the usual number of private prayers launched that night, as the realization grew that this was not another exercise, and that at dawn metal would be flying both ways. Friends gravitated together. I noticed no bravado or even the normal crap game. An engineer played an accordion, but there was no singing. Reveille was to be at 0200 with assault craft loading an hour later. The prospect did not lull anyone to sleep, but most went to their bunks early. I prayed, as always, but do not recall just how my petition was couched. It was probably rather personalized. Then I lay on a bunk in that strangely lonely cabin and leafed through a Collier's magazine. The magazine was full of war pieces that I found vapid, as wartime writing tends to be, all to the effect of how well everything was going. So I put it down and tried to sleep. I was not aware of any dread. Perhaps it was lack of imagination, or just curiosity about the trial of the drills we had practiced so long. I dozed, but was awake when the ship's gong sounded reveille.
In a few minutes, coinciding with the first break of dawn on this historic day, the most tremendous naval bombardment ever to blast out against the European continent will start. During the night, our warships, battleships, and cruisers went ahead of us as we neared the Baie de la Seine. They took their position ready to pour fire at the enemy gun emplacements as we lined up in the transport area. We dropped anchor at 0251. We are approximately 200,000 yards, 10 miles off the beach. Our big ships are in very close to bombard in this assault. The Texas is going to fire at 12,000 yards. The Arkansas is going to fire at a range of only 6,000 yards. At those ranges, those 14-inch guns mean business. Battleships, cruisers, destroyers, and monitors are going to blast at Hitler's Normandy defenses with rapid fire, concentrated fire, pinpoint fire, for 40 minutes before the first troops hit the beach. We know where Hitler's guns are. They are banked in concrete, and they will be hard to knock out. But we're going to give them an awful wallop. In addition to the warship firepower, our LCTs carry medium tanks, and these tanks will be cutting loose on the way in. They are scheduled to hit the beach at exactly H hour 0630. The infantry will hit 1 minute after our tanks hit, at H plus 1 minute. The naval bombardment is about to begin. H hour is fast approaching. The liberation of Europe is on the way.
Promptly at 4 o'clock, the transport stopped engines and we all clambered over the iron rails into the landing craft which hung from the side of the ship. Each man was helped in and his equipment handed over to him. Voices could be heard all over, calling to friends in other boats. I can distinctly remember looking at George Roach, who was the assistant flamethrower in my boat team, and how he smiled back there in the dark. He was my special pal and a young fellow of 18 and not too heavily built. I wondered at the time how he would make out carrying the 60-pound can of fuel.
Instead of our regular packs, we had been issued assault jackets, sort of vest-like garment with many pockets and pull-strap fasteners to yank off in a hurry. In the various pockets, we stored K-rations, a quarter pound of dynamite with fuse, hand grenades, smoke grenades, a syringe, and morphine. Besides our regular M1 clips, we had two slings of ammo belts slung across our shoulders. On our backs, we carried an entrenching tool, a bayonet, and a poncho, and whatever else we could stuff in. Altogether, our equipment weighed about 70 pounds.
The channel was extremely rough, and it wasn't long before we had to help the craft's pumps by bailing water with our helmets. The cold spray blew in, and soon we were soaked.
By this time, some of the guys were seasick and some were arguing over little things that didn't count. Some guys, like myself, were just standing there in the boat, thinking and shivering.
I remember the battleship Texas firing broadsides into the shore while we were close by. Oh, it was god-awful, terrible explosions, muzzle blasts in our ears when they fired. The smoke ring passed us and it looked like a funnel of a tornado growing larger and larger and finally dissipating. I don't believe we should have been that close because we actually felt the muzzle blast. All kinds of ships were firing. A French cruiser painted in camouflage did a good job of getting close to the shore, inviting the Germans to do battle. She shelled the hell out of the beach. All the ships did a great job except the LCT rocket ships, which didn't get close enough to hit their targets. Destroyers came within 1,000 yards of the shore and let go their 5 and 6 inch guns. It must have been terrible on the other end of that artillery.
My thinking as we approached the beach was that if the boat didn't hurry up and get us in, I would die from seasickness. At this point, death is not so dreadful. I didn't care what the Germans had to offer. I had to set foot on dry land.
As we got closer to the shore, the British guys in our boat kind of said to us, "You know, we're going to drop this ramp, and as soon as we do, we're going to back out. So you guys better be ready to get off. Our instructions are to get you in and get right out, so we don't create a traffic problem with the other teams coming in behind you."
As the ramp lowered, enemy machine guns opened up, firing directly into our boat. Captain Zabacosta was first off and first hit. Staff Sergeant Dick Wright, Communications Sergeant from Lynchburg, was second, and he was also hit as he left the boat, falling into the water. A medic was third, and I didn't see what happened to him. Being fourth, I caught my heel in the ramp and fell sideways, out of the path of the machine gun, and this undoubtedly saved my life. All the men that followed were either killed by the Germans or drowned.
We ultimately got to a point where the British coxswain on our boat said, "I'm aground, I'm aground." He dropped the ramp, and Lieutenant Anderson said, "All out," jumped in the water, and disappeared beneath the waves. Someone in front of the boat reached down and dragged him back in. Sergeant Vandervoort, I think it was, simply put his Tommy gun in the ribs of the coxswain and said, "I think you had better get us ashore." I might say that our boat, under those circumstances, probably got closer to the beach than any other, because we were able to get out without getting into water deeper than our knees.
The front of the boat was going up and down, and they were shooting at us. Some of us were going over the side because some were getting shot as soon as they got off the front. One man went off the ramp when it was way up in the air, and it came right down and hit him on the head and killed him. I jumped off the side and was bobbing around in the water. I just bobbed around trying to act like I was dead because I had a friend near me in the water who was hollering and waving his arms and carrying on, and he was shot by a sniper on a cliff. So I didn't act like I was swimming. I just let the tide take me in. There was a landing craft beached in front of us with a GI going around in the propeller. There were people on the beach with no heads, no arms.
As we jumped off the ramp, we sunk completely under with the weight of all our gear. I will never forget the feeling of panic I experienced at that moment. Thankfully, we had been taught in training how to strap on our packs and equipment in such a way as to get rid of it in a hurry. I was able to eject all my equipment, with the exception of a gas mask and steel helmet, and leapt upward from the ocean floor, finally getting my head above water. I started swimming for the beach. The weight of the soaked clothes, the boots, gas mask, and steel helmet made it near impossible, but I did finally reach water hip deep and was able to stand up. I was near exhaustion by this time and felt as though my body weighed 300 pounds.
No one thought the enemy was going to give us this kind of opposition on the water's edge. This turned boys into men. Some would be very brave men. Others would soon be dead men. But all those who survived would be frightened men. Some wet their britches. Others cried unashamedly. Many just had to find it within themselves to get the job done. This is where the discipline and training took over.
While pinned down on the beach, I watched incoming landing craft being shot at. One of them carried Battalion Surgeon Captain Robert Ware, a man I knew from my hometown, Madison Heights, Virginia.
The doctor had flaming red hair. I watched him as he disembarked, and that machine gun opened up, cutting him down. I'll never forget his helmet flying off and seeing all that red hair.
There was a pal of mine from Chicago with me as we got to the edge of the water, and I said to him, "Let's go." And we took off across the beach and ran. I really didn't think I would make it. I didn't think there was any way you could get across that beach and survive. I really thought that was my last day, but you don't want your friends to know that you're afraid, so you bluff, you know, act big and tough. But really, you're scared to death. It was a long, long beach and a long run, and I could feel the tracers going by. Bullets hit my heel and my canteen and went through my pack, but didn't touch me. One buddy ran ahead of us and fell into the beach. We were so loaded down with equipment that he stumbled and fell, and they shot him, and he fell into a puddle of water, which turned red.
As soon as I could get myself oriented and get the strength to get up, I realized I could hardly see because I was wearing glasses and my glasses were coated with salt. Eventually, I saw our mortar team about 20 yards onto the beach, with the men lying down next to the mortar, not firing. I called to ask them what was happening, and they said they were hit and they just couldn't fire the mortar even though it was set up for firing. The sergeant in charge asked me to fire it. I fired two or three rounds and they flew out but did not explode. The sergeant yelled, "Murdoch, you dumb bastard, you're not pulling the firing pins." I had never fired mortar rounds before. Then I started to move forward, creeping and crawling, and I realized that my rifle wouldn't fire because the sand had cemented the operating rod. I smashed it with my bayonet handle, but it still wouldn't work. I finally came to one of the underwater obstacles, which, since we landed at low tide, was out of the water. There were two people there, and I spoke to them for a few moments, and then I saw George Roach. He said all the officers were dead, all the non-coms were dead, and that as far as he could see, he and I, as PFCs, were the senior men on the beach. There were 13 of us alive out of 205.
I remember they gave us this little vial of morphine to break and stick in your arm in case you got hit and was dying. It made dying easier. I don't think I had that morphine for over 1 minute after I got on the beach. I gave it to another fella. All these screaming things, mortars, artillery shells and all. You hear them whistling, you'd hit the dirt. Well, when you hit the dirt, every time you hit it, you was on top of another dead GI. There wasn't any such thing as digging a foxhole in that sand. The only thing I wanted was a cigarette. I asked this medic that was running across, "You got a dry cigarette?" He handed me a cigarette and was hit with something. I don't know what it was, but his entire body, his insides and everything, was flown all over me. Must have been a mortar that hit him, I don't know.
While resting behind the obstacles, Private Gillingham, a young soldier, fell in beside me, white with fear. He seemed to be begging for help with his eyes. His look was that of a child asking what to do. I said, "Gillingham, let's stay separated as much as we can, because the Germans will fire at two quicker than one." He remained silent as I jumped up and ran forward again. I heard a shell coming and dove into the sand face down. Shrapnel rose over my head and hit all around me, blowing me 3 or 4 feet. My rifle was ripped from my hand, and my helmet went 25 or 30 feet in front of me. When I started to jump up and run, a sharp pain hit my spine from my neck to my lower back. I pulled myself by my elbows to my rifle, then retrieved my helmet and dragged myself into the hole the shell had made. As soon as I felt stronger, I got out of the hole and ran forward as machine gun bullets kicked up sand to the right of me. As the bullets came closer, I dropped to the sand and waited to be hit. I looked up to see the bullets hitting on my left side again. Again, I jumped up and ran, falling down each time machine gun fire came close. I continued doing this until I reached the sea wall. The shell that injured me took Gillingham's chin off, including the bone, except for a small piece of flesh. He tried to hold his chin in place as he ran toward the sea wall. He made it to the sea wall where Bill Hawks and I gave him his morphine shot. We stayed with him for approximately 30 minutes until he died. The entire time, he remained conscious and aware that he was dying.
At this point, we were not sure the evasion would succeed. Our company was shot up so badly that there was no organization, and we didn't know what other sectors were doing. You can't imagine how helpless it was to be lying on that beach, and those snipers shooting at everything that moved.
We were disorganized because everyone was in the wrong place, and 3 out of 4 of the company commanders were killed. We didn't move off the beach as we would have liked.
About 7 or 8 in the morning, we were being urged by braver and more sensible non-coms and 1 or 2 surviving officers to get off the beach and up the bluffs to higher ground. More men from other landing craft behind us were making it across the beach and joining the congestion at the seawall. It would be some time before enough courage returned for us to attempt movement up the slopes and up the beach. Scared, worried, and often praying, I had been busy helping some of the wounded. Most of the time, moving in a crouched position, a few of us helped move the helpless to secure areas. Once or twice, I was able to control my fear enough to race across the sand to drag a helpless GI from drowning in the incoming tide. That was the extent of my bravery that morning. Then clear thinking replaced some of our fear, and many of us accepted the fact that we had to get off the beach or die where we were. We got off the beach.
From the top of the hill, the view of the fleet out in the channel was awesome. Looking down on the slaughter of the men and the destruction of the equipment was hard to fathom. I never heard one man say, "Hell, this is not what it's supposed to be like. Let's go back." There was so much going on that all you could think about was to keep your ass alive.
When we got near the top of the cliff, I talked to Sergeant England, who had also been injured. He told me I was pale, and I showed him my leg, which was now swelling and turning different colors. Sergeant England told me to go back to the beach and get a medic to tag me so that I could be transported back to a ship. As I painfully walked back to the beach, thousands of bodies were lying there. You could walk on the bodies as far as you could see along the beach without touching the ground. Parts of bodies, heads, legs, and arms, floated in the sea. Medics were walking up and down, tagging the wounded. As I stepped gently between my American comrades, I realized what being in the first wave was all about.
Of all the capacities that the years diminish, none leaves a greater void than the loss of the youthful ability for friendships without the questioning and restraints that complicate those of later life. I feel this void now in looking back upon friends gone on that June 6th. Together we had been through months and years of wartime and confusion and strains, marched countless tedious miles, lived in mud and dust, heat and cold. I knew their problems, both duty and personal, and they knew mine. The battalion and its business occupied nearly all our time and thoughts, and it did not matter what else we might have or not have in common. Then it all came down to this brief first day of battle on the coast of Normandy. And for so many of them, it ended. For the rest of us, what has been since has not been the same.
These are the names of the veterans whose stories you've heard, survivors of the first waves to go ashore on Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. John Barnes, Charles Coffin, Warner Hamlet, William Jones, William Lewis, Robert Miller, Victor Miller, Gilbert Murdoch, Arthur Neumeier, Harry Parley, George Roach, Robert Sales, and Robert Slaughter.
D-Day Diary was produced by Margaret West and Nina Ellis. Special thanks to the actors, Stevie Ray Dallimore, Kevin Dykstra, Ron Johns, Nick Newlin, John Radulovic, Rob Rand, Rob Robinson, Taki Talanidis, Craig Wallace, Tom West, Foster Wiley, and Chuck Young. Thanks also to Peggy O'Brien of the Folger Theater in Washington, D.C., Christopher and Susan Koch, and Jim Smith of Muddy Hole Studios. The studio engineer was Robin Wise. Next week on Soundprint, the story of the guys who dig those big holes in the ground.
It's more economic than it is anything else. We don't come here for the glory of being the first one to be where nobody else has walked, you know. It's basic economic. You got to feed your family, pay your bills, and try to get ahead in this life. And that's the whole picture.
Sandhogs, next week on Soundprint, and in 2 weeks, a story about the decline of the fisheries off Newfoundland.
They called a moratorium, they left us high and dry.
You've got to see it. You've got to take people out there and say, you know, this is where we used to find hundreds of thousands of tons of fish, and show them on the echo sounder that it's absolutely bare water. There's nothing there.
Just another kind of dole. Now which side are you on? Which side are you on?
On the package in 2 weeks on Soundprint, and in 3 weeks, the inner life of a quadriplegic.
The particular morning of Amanda's accident, Amanda had asked me to drive her to school, and she just started high school. So off she went, and we arranged to meet at my mother's place, where Amanda would go from there to dancing classes. And actually, before Amanda went, she walked across the road and she turned around and ran back and kissed me and said, "I love you, Mum." And sadly, that was the last time I saw her walk, indeed run.
All of my dreams are about dancing, coming up on Soundprint. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Today's program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation. Write us with your ideas and comments. Write Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street, Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50. If you want to order with a credit card, call us at 202-885-1285. That's 202-885-1285. On the Internet, our address is soundprint@american.edu. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria De Freitas, Production Assistant Francesca Raymond. Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett. This is NPR, National Public Radio.